Going to begin. As always, and you write your comments there on the side. I'll get to that at the end. I need to first, before we begin, I want to respond to a few comments. First of all, the issue that I only saw afterwards, the big debate in the chat over the definition of a yeshiva. People were really going at it. And I was asked the question, is there a yeshiva older than the Mir? And actually, even without seeing the comments, I came up with the Beit El. The thing is that some of you not. I hear a voice out back. I want some of you said that maybe it is true from the Ashkenazic perspective. We'd call this I don't know, a base medrash more because we think of yeshivas as different shiurim and a certain age group. But it was a yeshiva. And anyone who's interested in that, here's his whole book by Pinchas Giller on it, Shalom Sharabi and the Kabbalists of Beit El. It's a Kabbalistic yeshiva. It still exists to this day. They study things other than Kabbalah, but that's the Yeshivat HaMakubalim Beit El. So if anyone wants more about that. Next thing, in addition, let me mute everyone here. In addition, I mentioned about Harbin. Dara Horn, incidentally, I said I thought it was her article was in Jewish Review of Books. It's actually Tablet. You can see it online. She calls it Cities of Ice, a dispatch from frozen Harbin where Jews once flourished. And I want to, and they do have a big ice festival. It's the biggest one. You can go see pictures of it. I want to thank Josh Gordon for saying he's been to Harbin a number of times, and he actually, they have a cemetery there. It still exists. He sent me pictures of with Ehud Olmert's family and their tombstones, and also Aaron Kislev, the Rav we mentioned last class. His tombstone still survives, although we don't have a picture of that. One of you asked me about the dateline. First of all, where the Tshuva of Rav Nathanson is? It's in Sholem Meshiv, Madura Riva, Chelak Beis, Simon Kufnadal. But someone asked me about what's this business. Where I said, or C. Pesach Frank, or Visal Meltzer, that there is no dateline in the Torah. You can set the dateline wherever you want it. What's that based on? Well, it's based on the fact that the Gemara says if you don't know, you're in a desert, you don't know what day Shabbos is, you're supposed to just count 6 days, and on the seventh day, that's Shabbos, but if for you, but nevertheless, if then you arrive in a city, and they tell you, well, no, Shabbos is yesterday or tomorrow. You're supposed to follow the city. So there's this conception that you're supposed to be subservient to wherever place you go to. And since they already celebrated Shabbos in Japan, one of you wanted to know like where I got this idea about Rav Yoshev. Well, it's right in this book, Hashakdan, Volume 3. It tells you explicitly on page 106 that he agreed with the decision of the Jerusalem rabbis that you keep Shabbos on Saturday in Japan. And the primary reason, Ikar HaSvara, was because there already was a settlement there that had observing Shabbos on Saturday. So since there's a dispute where to put it, and some people hold in any event that the dateline halakhically should be very close to the international dateline, Rav Yosef held as well that you don't change the day. And I think that is the standard position. Definitely for people who live there. Two other things before we begin, and then I'm going to get to the big thing that Nat Lewin sent me, and that'll get us right on. I mentioned, I didn't get a chance to show you, but now I can. Here is the, wrong thing. Let me do this again. I want to show you the Sas Emes that was hoping it would no, but I'm having a lot of problems for some reason. It's don't know why it's not letting me share things that are on my laptop here. I want to show you a picture of the Sfas Emes. Okay, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do it. I will be able to show you what Nat sent me. Let me try just quickly one more thing here. No, okay, well, here it is. I'll show you any event. I'll show you from my from the screen here. Here, you see, Sfas Emes? Look at the bottom. It was printed by Yeshiva Sachmeg Lublin in Shanghai. Okay, now hopefully the next thing I'll show you worked. Mickey Abraham, we're going to talk today about one of the Chachamim. He served as a Chacham of the Sephardic community. His name was David Abraham, and we have a number of his family that are listening. So one of them, Mickey Abraham, sent me something I should have mentioned, that when the Emir Yeshiva came to Kobe, there actually was a Sephardic community there as well as an Ashkenazi community, and there's a man named Nissim Tawil, who was very helpful to the Emir Yeshiva. You can read his, I guess, great-granddaughter, Allison Tawil, has an article in the YU Observer. You just got to Google Nissim Tawil, Allison Tawil, and you can read all about how he put up guarantee money so the Emir Yeshiva could come to Japan. And that's very great. Ashkenazim and Sephardim joining together. Okay, now fine. Now I want to get to the important thing. One more thing, actually. If you're interested in Chatz Sofer, in February 2nd, 1941, February 20th, 1941, there's an interview with Reb Lazer Yehuda Finkel, who's already in the land of Israel. And in the interview, he talks about how all the great rabbis who are soon going to be coming to Israel, Eretz Yisrael, are getting out. He mentions Rav Aaron Cutler. Then he mentions Rav Hanan Wasserman, hopes to come to Eretz Yisrael soon. He mentions Rav Avram Grozinski. These are people who were killed, and it's unfortunate. Okay, now before we begin, I want to say something important, and I thank Nat Lewin for sending it to me. And I'm saying it publicly here because this is going to set the record straight, I hope, on something. What I told you, I gave you the whole story about Nathan Gutworth from the Netherlands, and this, and that he's the reason for the whole Sugihara Curacao angle, that he was the one who came up with the idea of going to Curacao, and then he got the visas, and then he got Sugihara. And then the other part of the story is that he then told the Mir students that. That is found in numerous places. That's found in the book we've been speaking about, the Sugihara book. That story is repeated in, I'll show you another book where it's repeated, an important book we're going to come back to later today. It's repeated in this book by David Kranzler, Japanese Nazis and Jews. It's in the Hebrew volume. Everywhere they give that story. And yet, I have to say, after what Nat Lewin himself, I'm sure many of you know who Nat Lewin is, the famous constitutional lawyer, who himself left on a Sugihara visa. In fact, I'm going to show you the visa right here. I'll show you the Sugihara visa. Well, not Sugihara visa, his, if I can get it up here. Here it is. This is Nat Lewin's, and it has his father, his mother, and him. This is actually the safe conduct pass. I mentioned how they didn't have the people who were Polish citizens. Poland ceased to exist as a country, but there was a out of the British embassy, British consulate in Kovno, the Polish government in exile was giving out papers. For some reason, I asked Nat, you'll have to send it to you, why his father got it from Latvia. This is a safe conduct pass, which functioned as a passport. What Nat sent me, and there's also an article that his daughter, Eliza, wrote up, is despite everything that appears in all the books, including by Moshe Tokayer, who wrote a whole book that deals with this, it's actually not true. The first one was actually Nat Lewin's family. And in fact, if you look at the numbers, I have the list of the visas. His father, well, the visa I just showed you, as well as his grandmother and his uncle, these were talking 16, 17, 18. Gutworth was not, he was over 1,000 in terms of the number of visa. The story is, it's actually basically the same story, except that it was Nat's mother and his uncle were also from the Netherlands. And they came up with the whole thing. Anyone is interested, or you can just Google it and you can read the whole story. Eliza Lewin article, How My Grandmother's Chutzpah Helped Sugihara Rescue Thousands of Jews. This also explains something interesting because we have the Dutch consul's a letter, an interview he gave, where he talks about we came to this whole idea because a Dutchman, came to me with this. And everyone says, well, the person he's referring to is Gutworth. But it's clear that the person he's referring to is actually Nat Lewin's uncle, Leo, who was Dutch. That's who it's, and he's, and he, they got it before Gutworth got it, like 2 weeks before he got it. And this is actually pointed out, he says, correctly by Varhoftig in his book as well. So I do want to just, set the record straight. I'm always a stickler that although Nathan Gutworth thought he was the first, it seems, and the story is constantly told, and maybe he told the Mir people about it, I don't know, but it was actually Nat Lewin's family. They're literally the very first, and 16, 17, 18, that's the numbers they are on for the visas. Actually, so the Gutworth is 1,264, and his visa is issued in August 6, 1940, and Nat Lewin's parents, that's a few weeks before that. So, okay, I hope we set the record straight now. Now we just have to get the books to say that as well. So, okay, let us begin now. If there's any questions or comments, we'll take that at the end. Okay, so the Mir Yeshiva is so Shanghai is now going to be the place of refuge for the Mir Yeshiva. It's certain, though, that no one ever intended this beforehand as the Yeshiva's place of refuge. In fact, when the Yeshiva was still in Europe, Leitner, the author of this book, Operation Torah Rescue, nice title for it. There's two actually editions of this, but he tells how he heard that you can get into Shanghai. And he went to Rav Chisko Levinstein himself and said, should I go to Shanghai? And Rav Chisko said not to. Said, Shanghai is not the sort of place for a young yeshiva student to maintain a Torah lifestyle. Not only was Shanghai, and all of China for that matter, regarded as a place of idolatry. Real Avodah Zarah. If you look at the old Sfarim, they say whenever we mention idolaters, we don't mean refer to the people among who we live. We're talking about those idolaters in India and China, places like. Furthermore, Shanghai was known, I guess maybe it's like Bangkok is thought of today. It's a place of very seamy, a place of prostitution. It was a center of prostitution, so it's hardly the place that you're thinking that yeshiva students would go. In fact, in this book, by the way, Jewish women were involved in the prostitution as well. That's an interesting point. If you look at this book, which I'm going to show you right now, pull it up here. There's a number of books on Shanghai, but Escape to Shanghai, A Jewish Community in China. By James Ross. Very nice. He records all sorts of history of it and interviews and everything. On page 72, he writes as follows. In after speaking about the women, Jewish women who, because they couldn't support themselves, getting involved in prostitution, he writes, in Europe, the idea of a Jewish prostitute was unthinkable. Here in Shanghai, the old moral standards could not hold. Fact is, this statement is hardly correct. And I hope you're all sitting down because I'm going to tell you some things now that you might fall off your chair. Okay. Jewish women were very much involved in prostitution in Eastern Europe. According to an 1872 survey, just to give you statistics, 17% of the known prostitutes in Warsaw were Jewish. 27% of the prostitutes in Krakow were Jewish. And 47% in Vilna. In 1889, Jewish women were 22% of the licensed prostitutes in the Pale of Settlement. Where do all these statistics come from? They come from this book. Let me get it up here for you, which is a. Wonder where you can find my book here. I've got to pull it up here a second. And if you think that here, okay, let me pull up the screen now for you. And we'll see this now, I believe. Prostitution and Prejudice, the Jewish Fight Against White Slavery, 1870 to 1939. White slavery was, I hate to say it because we wouldn't like it if someone else said it, but Jews were involved in white slavery. In fact, in Argentina and Brazil, the Jews ran the white slavery. When we do our Torah in Motion trip to Argentina, we'll go see the separate cemeteries. They had separate cemeteries because the Jewish community would not allow the prostitutes and the pimps to be buried in the Jewish cemetery. That whole society, it was called the Tzvi Migdal Society. They had their own shul, their own rabbi, their own, everything. They're completely, and the mainstream Jewish community called them the Tmeim. And this happened in Brazil at all. So, and this went on until it was finally shut down, like in the late 30s. But this was a, I mean, this is reality. Furthermore, this goes back to medieval times. Jewish prostitution. The Akedas Yitzchak speaks about how communities themselves had houses of ill repute, run by the community. They thought it was better than the Jews going to the non-Jewish women, because it was also dangerous. So it's a capital offense. And the Akedas Yitzchak speaks about how he tries to tell them, this is crazy, this is terrible. We have examples in Prague. We have in Damascus even, there were Jewish prostitutes. So this is like a legend, like a myth that the Jews are, don't, there's no such thing as a Jewish shikker or a Jewish drunk. There's no such thing as a Jewish prostitute. And this, until you came to the state of Israel, it's not true at all. And therefore, contrary, I understand why Ross would say that because he has this myth. But unfortunately, the truth is not only that, we have at least two tshuvot by Rabbanim. Prostitutes, they never felt like they were not part of the Jewish community. They wanted to give money to the shul, in one case to buy the parochas. And that's found in the Rafal Ben Shimon of Cairo. The question is, are you allowed to accept their money and give them name recognition? Are they any different than in the Chayil Shabbos? So this is the Jewish community has always had everything. So it's nothing new. And unfortunately, you also had it in Shanghai. In fact, in a recent book about the experience of living in Shanghai, the book I mentioned, this book, Hazrul Keda, he speaks about the real contrast between the city, which contained every evil imaginable, and the yeshiva, which was an oasis of Torah and spirituality. I knew someone else. Let me show you this picture here. I don't know if anyone recognizes this individual. This is someone who died just a couple of months ago. He must have been about 95. His name is Rav Chaim Dov Ber Gulevsky. He was the grandson of Rav Simcha Zelig Rieger, the Dayan of Brisk. What do you mean, Brisk? The Dayan of Brisk? Didn't they have a Rav, the Brisker Rav, before that Rav Chaim? Yeah, but they didn't paskin. They left it, except for big things. But generally, Psak was left to the Dayan. This stuff here is a picture I took in his house. On the left, you have Reb Chaim, and on the right, it's Rav Simcha Zelig, who unfortunately was martyred in the Holocaust. But Rav Simcha Zelig, he was the Dayan of Brisk. Run-of-the-mill questions. Brisk was a fairly nice-sized city, but if it was a small city, they'd have to go, I guess, ask the Rav, but they could afford to have a Dayan. So Reb Chaim Soloveitchik wasn't poskening questions on kashrus of a chicken. He wasn't doing agunas either. He wasn't, Reb Chaim said, the job of the Rav, that's not the job, his job. The job of the Rav is, as he said, to take care of the widows and orphans. Reb Chaim didn't even speak. He never spoke, not even Shabbos HaGadol, Shabbos Shuvah. They were Magidim. But he was the Rav. And the community was proud to have him there, even though he, because he took care of it and he represented the community. So Rabbi Gulevsky was at Kletsk, and he is one of the students at Kletsk who actually got a visa, a Sugihara visa, and he made his way to Japan. And then he made his way from there to Shanghai. And in one of Rav Gruevsky's Sfarim. I took that picture, by the way, at his house in Borough Park. He taught at YU, believe it or not. When he came to America for a number of years, they used to have this thing. I don't know what it's been called now. Not the yeshiva program, but there was something else. Isaac Breuer College, I think they called it. But he taught there for many years, and he has a number of Sfarim. I mean, a lot of history too, although you have to take history with a grain of salt. But he writes as follows, that Shanghai, from the standpoint of sexual issues, was, quote, the lowest level of impurity. Using the language that the Gemara speaks about, that Egypt, that the Jews in Egypt had reached the lowest level of impurity, and that's what he says is. Nevertheless, even though Shanghai was in such a bad state, Rabbi Cheskel Levenstein, once they made it to Shanghai, was opposed to any of the students leaving Shanghai, much like he had earlier been opposed to any of the students leaving Japan, for he was worried it would mean the end of the yeshiva if everyone starts leaving. And this was not theoretical, because a number of the students actually had visas to enter the United States, Canada, even Paraguay, yet almost all of them chose to remain with the yeshiva. One of the students, by the way, who left Japan, not Shanghai, because not everyone listened to Rav Cheskel, was Rav Simcha Shetz, if that name means anything to you. He comes, he's a student of the Mir, also of the Brisker Rav. He comes to America and he teaches at Torah Vadas. But he's one of the ones who left, and others left. In fact, last class I mentioned at the end, because of the question, so I'll say it again, that a book, and the author, as I see, is listening to us right now. You can read this book about three Mir Yeshiva students who left Shanghai for the United States on December 4th, 1941, with a scheduled stop over in Manila. Unfortunately, the outbreak of World War II, the American entry of World War II, the beginning of war between America and Japan is just a few days after this. And therefore, they were stranded in the Philippines and were interned by the Japanese authority for 3 years. And Mordechai Soroka has told the story in a fascinating book, which I encourage everyone who's interested in this to read. I have no knowledge of this whatsoever until I read the book. And so you have a great title, also, A Mirror in Manila. I don't know, Mordechai, if this is a play on Thriller in Manila. I don't know, was that George Foreman and Muhammad Ali, or George Foreman and Joe Frazier? I don't know, but instead of Thriller in Manila, we have Mirror in Manila. It's funny about Manila. Let me tell you something. I was a scholar in residence at a show in Teaneck, the Shabbos before everything shut down. That is, we had Shabbos, and then a couple days later, everything was shut down. And I got to speak to J.J. Schachter there. It was at his show, and you might have seen the article in the Jewish Week. He had recently got back from Manila, because he's involved in this organization now, which I don't know who's funding it, in which they've identified Jewish soldiers all over the world who were killed in World War II and are buried in various cemeteries, but either have a cross or don't have any Jewish star. And he had just got back from Manila like a week before, and you can go online and see pictures. It's really very nice. The Israeli ambassador, the American ambassador, and they're giving kavod acharon to a Jewish soldier. I think it was only one, buried in Manila. They did this at Normandy and all other places. So, but you can learn about the Jews in Manila and the community that was there from the book. One other thing I have to mention, which isn't so pleasant, is that I see someone there. I'm an Amharic in boxing. Yes, it's Ali Frazier. Yes, I am an Amharic in boxing, but even though boxing used to have a lot of Jews in it as well. But okay, thank you for that. Preceding the arrival of Jews in Shanghai, I have to tell you that there were Jews in Shanghai. Remember, there's about 20,000 Jews who had been living in Shanghai already. So there's an old Sephardic community, we'll talk about it. There's an older Ashkenazi community. And then you had about 18,000, 17,000 who came in from Germany and Austria. There was opposition to the Mir Yeshiva coming in and to any more refugees coming in. What was the reason for this? Well, you can read about it in Kranzler's book on pages 268 and on. Basically, the problem was, I don't think they think it was, realized it was a matter of life and death. I guess they thought also if they protest to Japan, Japan would keep the Jews in Japan because they had no money. They had this, the community was enormously generous, but eventually, how much more can you do? And they said that two of the leaders of the community, of the Jewish community, it talks about it here, how they met with the Japanese officials and said that, we can't have any more. They couldn't support it, basically. That's what it says here. So I don't see that as anything bad necessarily. They felt that they couldn't, they didn't have any more money to support these people. And a good quote here. Lack of funds, fear in general. I mean, there comes a time, even the Chazal speak about aniyei ircha, the poor of your own. Of course, if it's a matter of life and death. But I think the logic was if you pressure the Japanese and let them know we just can't take anymore, then maybe they'd leave them in Kobe. What do they need to bring any more people coming here? Aniyei ircha, it means that when you have some charity, you have to support your own first. Yes, you should give money for everyone, but the majority, and if you can't support others, you have to support your own. And that's not just a nice thing. That's at least according to Pershut Shachter, that's he came to my town about and spoke about this. It's actually, he claims it's actually real halacha to the extent that he said that you're forbidden. That it, let's say you have to halachically support, let's say, your local institutions. Then if you want to give 10% to other institutions, you can. But he thinks it's actually against halacha. If you're living in, let's say, a town, for you to give all your money, let's say, to the Mir Yeshiva in Brooklyn, if you're living in Los Angeles, as opposed to your own school, that he thinks you're obligated to support your own school. And then with the leftover, you give it to the others. But then in response to a question, he said, however, if you have a shaychus, a connection, like let's say you went to the Mir, or your son goes to the Mir, then that's considered your yeshiva also. So then you could live in Los Angeles or Seattle, then you could give most of your money to that. But just because you feel, hey, you like this, and I know that he even feels that they should keep these yeshivas out, these parlor meetings from local communities. I don't know if everyone agrees with that, and if they see it, but that's what they were arguing, the Shanghai leadership. Now, who are these people in Shanghai, as I said? Well, first of all, as I said, there was an established community in Shanghai of Sephardic Jews who had come since the end of the 19th century. You have Iraqi Jews, they went to India, they went to Shanghai, they went to Hong Kong. The Sassoons were very influential in this as well. They had a chacham, an unofficial chacham. I told you his name, David Abraham. I want to see if I can get the picture here that shows up on the screen. Don't know why I'm having such a problem. I'll show you the picture in the book then. I'll just hold it up. I'm doing everything I'm supposed to be doing, I think, here. Let me try it one more time. I tested it before and it said if I went each one individually, it would work. Let me try one more time here. The picture. There's a few pictures we have of him. There it goes. So it's not such a clear picture, but you see, I'm not sure, maybe one of the family members could say who the little boy is. That's Chacham Abraham. He was a merchant. In Kranzler's book, he calls him a, quote, scholar merchant, but he's a Talmud Chacham. And his father was a Talmud Chacham. Why didn't they have a rabbi? Well, there hadn't been a rabbi in the community in Shanghai since the early 1920s, and this rabbi was an Ashkenazi, incidentally, named Hirsch. Following him, there was a man, he wasn't a rabbi, he was the head of the school. His name was Mendel Brown, needless to say, another Ashkenazi. I don't know why they never appointed another official rabbi. For matters of Jewish law, they would go to the Ashkenazic rabbi, who I will show you him again as well, his picture. So he was the unofficial Chacham. And there also was a community of Ashkenazic Jews under the leadership of a rabbi named Meir Ashkenazi. Let me just see if I can pull a picture of him here. Good picture because I don't want to play games with the with not being able to get it. Ah, okay, I got a picture for you. Let me show you. There's a website called Kvarim, which here you go on the right there. You could see his picture. also in the mid on the right, that's his picture. We've also in the middle there as well. So and on the left you see a picture of him over right over here. And the Shliach to Shanghai. You see this right here? An entire book or not an art, it's an article, not a story, sorry. It's actually an online thing. So he was a Chabad rabbi, believe it or not. He had been in Vladivostok, but he had come to Shanghai in 1926. He would remain in Shanghai until 1949 when he moves to Brooklyn, where he dies in 1954. Obviously, the arrival of the Mir Yeshiva was going to have a great impact on the city. But I'll show you something that a lot of people don't realize. Again, I hope I can show you that Torah did not start with the Mir Yeshiva arriving. What I'm trying to do now is pull you up something. I'm going to stop it again. I'm going to try to work a second ago. If not, I can try to pull it up. Let me try one more time here. If not, I'm going to show you the picture myself. Okay, yeah, let me try this here. Unfortunately, it's let's try it. Here we go. Oh, ah, there you go. It's erratic, but you can see it. This is a kuntres, a little Torah publication. It's called Or Torah Mizrach. It's dedicated to Torah and Musar. It's put out by his name is Eliezer Bricks. Tell me from Pinsk. He was in Yeshiva Pinsk, and then look what it says. Now he's in Yeshivat Mizrach HaRachok in Shanghai, the Far East Yeshiva, and you see published in Shanghai, 1941. This is before the Mir Yeshiva students arrive. They had this Yeshiva Mizrach HaRachok. If you look in this little booklet, which I could send anyone a copy, it begins with an article, a Torah article by Rabbi Ashkenazi, who served as the Rosh Yeshiva of this yeshiva, or Torah Mimizrach. Soon the Chabad group would come, the Lubavitch group, and they opened the yeshiva there. Yeshiva's Tumchei Tamimim. And this yeshiva, it followed the exact same path as the Mir Yeshiva with the Sugi Haravizas. Then Rabbi Ashkenazi becomes, and he is a real Talmid Chacham. He's not like today. Sometimes you find shlichim, which are not such great Talmid Chachamim. He's a very, very big Talmid Chacham. And once the Lubavitch students come, he becomes the Rosh Yeshiva of their yeshiva, and he begins to focus on the Tumchei Tamimim yeshiva. I believe that this yeshiva, Mizrach HaRachok, closes down, because I can find no references to it after 1941. So what happened to the students? We know that a number of students joined Mir Yeshiva, and others, more Hasidic inclinations, they joined Chachmei Lublin, and others just went place to place, weren't particularly connected, some were with Chabad. Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, who's functioning as the Rosh Yeshiva in Shanghai, the son-in-law of Rav Lezer Yudofinkel, he invited the Lubavitch students. There's about 30 Lubavitch students. We have a list of their names. I can show you pictures of them, to join the Mir Yeshiva. Amazing when you think about it, because of what we're going to see. But they were invited to join the Mir Yeshiva. And they preferred to remain as a separate group, as we can understand. New information. Someone asked me this a couple days ago. New information has recently come to light, which Chabad made a big deal about. How, see, as I mentioned, money was sent by the Vad Hatzalah in America, and that's what supported the yeshiva students at the Mir. So much so that the yeshiva students were in a better shape than the typical refugee, and we'll see how it led to some negative feelings. However, the money that came from the Vad Hatzalah in America, and there's no doubt about this, came with instructions to exclude the Lubavitch students. And what's going on here? Why would they be excluded? And even though it came with instructions, that wasn't always the case. They sometimes did let them have it in Shanghai. And apparently, Rav Chaim Shmulevitz was not really opposed to letting the Lubavitch students have it, but it came, and some of it came directly to Rav Meir Ashkenazi, with instructions that no Lubavitch students. Now, some have viewed this as a continuation of the difficult relationship between Lubavitch and the yeshiva world that existed in Europe. It's no secret that Lubavitch has always gone their own way in many things that they don't feel like they're a part of the yeshiva world. They're their own. They're Lubavitch. They're their own empire. It could be that's the reason. After the war, there was a case before Besdin, where Rabbi Ashkenazi was charged with disregarding the instructions that Lubavitch students not receive aid sent from Vlad Hatzala. He actually wins the case. But, money came to him, care packages as well, and he distributed them. He's a Lubavitcher, so what would you expect? Now, I don't want to get into it now whether Vlad Hatzala had any justification for excluding Lubavitch students from its aid. And in one of the websites of Chabad, they use this to attack Rav Aaron Cutler, who, in any event, they don't like Rav Aaron Cutler because he was very anti-Chabad. But if you look at the documents, Rav Aaron Cutler is never mentioned at all. It's Rav Kalmanovich. He's the one who gives the instructions. I would only suggest that if you want to look at it from the Vlad Hatzala's perspective, and this is not mentioned in all the attacks on the Vlad Hatzala, the Frida Rebbe, the Rayatz, had his own fund for Shanghai, and he raised his own money. So first of all, the Vlad Hatzala could have assumed that why do we need to support the Lubavitch students? The Rayatz is raising money himself for the Shanghai Lubavitch students, and he's not giving that money to the Mir students. And also, they might have felt that the Rayatz's fundraising efforts hurt Vlad Hatzala, which they might have, because Vlad Hatzala comes to town raising money for Shanghai students, and they might say, well, 2 weeks ago, the Lubavitch emissary was here, and we already gave money for Shanghai. So we could see that it wouldn't necessarily be such a great relationship. And I'll just repeat what I said. Rav Meir Ashkenazi won the Din Torah that went before the Beis Din. I haven't been able to find out who was on the Beis Din. As far as I know, it wasn't a Gudas Rabbani, but I don't know who was on the Beis Din. It's not on the documentation, as far as I know. In addition to Lubavitch, there were also students from, as we said, the Hasidic students from Yeshiva Chochmei Lublin who escaped to Shanghai, and they reestablished their yeshiva there as well. Lubavitch and Chochmei Lublin were never in the same building with Mir. First, they were separate, and then they shared a building in one of the other shuls. We're going to talk about where the Mir was. They were not together. And then there were individual students. You had Telzers, you had Kletsk, you had Kamenetz, all the people who had the foresight to get out of Europe, who got the Japanese transit visas. And some of them would have joined the Mir Yeshiva. There was a rabbi in Shanghai who also got out. His name was Joseph Seitan. Not Zeitlin, Zeitin. He was a rabbi in America after the war as well, and he served on the Beis Din in Shanghai during the war. He wrote an article about Torah life, basically, in Shanghai, and he said something amazing, which is true. During the years of World War II, the most active place, he says, of rabbinic studies was Shanghai. And I believe that's the case. If you look at Jerusalem, you had nothing in B'nai Brak. Jerusalem, what'd you have there? You didn't have the numbers. If you look at the amount of people studying, Mir had about 325 to 350. Lublin had about 30. Lubavitch had 30. You're talking about, not to mention, we're going to hear about the local Sephardic kids and the Ashkenazi kids who start studying at the Mir Yeshiva. So you probably get up to close to 500 people, at least 450 full-time Torah students. When the State of Israel was founded, I forget the number they give. I think it was, this is after the war. I think the number they gave is what, 700 or something? Full-time Torah students. That's why Ben-Gurion agreed with this deal. So the center of Torah study in the world, 41, 42, 43, 44, 45, if you assume center, meaning where the most is going on, is of all places, Shanghai. Okay, so the Mir students arrive in Shanghai. As we saw last class, they're kicked out of Kobe and the Japanese who lived in Kobe. Some of them were sent to Japan, to Shanghai. Others were kept basically under house arrest. Some of these people, a lot of the Sephardim, incidentally, were English citizens, so from India. So that put them in another, also in a bad situation because now they're part of the enemy. But they come to Shanghai, and we have to thank, first of all, the Sephardic community for what I'm going to tell you now. And we also have to thank Rabbi Ashkenazi, because Rabbi Ashkenazi, he was living in a midbar, a desert. In Vladivostok, it was nothing was there. He had no one to talk to and learning, nothing. And in Shanghai, he had nothing. And now all of a sudden, you have an enormous Torah community. But it's one thing when you get 30 Chabad students or Chachmei Kabun or individual. Here we're talking about 350, let's say, together with the, and not to mention all the wives and there's children coming there. What an operation. How are we going to, where are we going to put these people? Where are they going to live? How are we going to support them? Where are they going to learn? If it's a yeshiva, you need to put them together. Rabbi Ashkenazi arranges everything so they could pick up learning. Just like in Japan, they started learning and they had no problem there as a group. They're going to start learning here. Although in Japan, they couldn't all fit exactly together. They were in different places. And the relationship between Rami Ashkenazi and the Mir Yeshiva is great. He's always portrayed by the Mir in a very positive manner. The Mir Yeshiva was careful not to be put under his control. He would have been very happy to be in charge, but it was a very good relationship. The members of the Sephardic community, we have to pay them a lot of respect for what they did. In particular, Chacham Abraham. I want to read you something now in the book on the Mir Yeshiva about Chacham Abraham, Peshvei 586. Let me start with that. To get a sense of what, because remember, these were Sephardim. What do they know about Lithuanian yeshivas? This is a very foreign concept, you know, giant yeshivas. Yeah, it's yeshivas in the Sephardic world, but not like these giant yeshivas. And the whole approach is very different. But the book tells about how Chacham Abraham, who was a, you know, who had great respect with all his soul for the rabbis and for the yeshiva students, was completely dedicated to it and helped out very much. Any request that the yeshiva had, they went to Chacham Abraham and he could take care of it. Even strange requests. One of the most strange requests is they said to Chacham Abraham, you know, we get to the yeshiva, and I'll tell you in a minute where the yeshiva is. That's an unbelievable story in and of itself. We need shtenders. Chacham Abraham had no idea what's a shtender. What do you need? First of all, what do you need a shtender for? And what is a shtender? And so they explained to him, well, that's how we learn with these shtenders. Well, there was in the Sephardic community a Jew there, and he continues, describes the whole thing, who owned a furniture place. And so he came down, they brought his people down to look, and they did a drawing and they explained it. And let me show you the picture now, the famous picture. I'll get you to this picture. All these shtenders were made by the Chinese workmen that worked for the Jewish furniture manufacturer based on a description, because there weren't any shtenders in the entire Hong Kong. Later, I'll tell you who some of these people are in the picture. So, okay, so where to put them? Well, they put them in this synagogue. Let me show you, go back to the picture. It's called Beth Aaron. Give you a picture of the synagogue. Where is it? Here. Picture. There it is. Beth Aaron Synagogue in Shanghai, which unfortunately you can't see anymore because it was destroyed in 1985. This synagogue was opened in 1927, and it was built by the famous Iraqi Jewish businessman named Silas Aaron Hardoon. I want to show you his picture first. I found a picture of him online. Where's the pictures? Here he is. Hardoon was born in Baghdad, then he went to India, made his way to Shanghai. At the time of his death in 1931, he was regarded as the richest man, not the richest Jew, the richest man in Asia. He had, in today's money, I just checked it before on Wikipedia, the equivalent of $15 billion. And that would make him even today a very, very wealthy man. He was working with the Sassoon family, and then he was working for them when he came to Shanghai, and then he went on his own real estate. He's remembered today If you go to Shanghai, you can see the Nanjing Road, and he built it. Now, unusual for his time, he married a local Chinese woman whose father but might have been Jewish, but that we don't know. And she was Buddhist, and he himself was very interested in Buddhism. He had this like big estate, and Buddhist monks lived on the estate, and he loved talking to them. And he cut himself off from the Jewish community. He basically had nothing to do with Jewish community. He was very charitable. He gave to hospitals, museums, Buddhist institutions, all sorts of stuff. But he had nothing to do with Judaism. And yet, deep down, he did have some connection because he was not totally alienated. In the last decade of his life, and the story is he had a dream, his father, whatever, he decided to build a synagogue, Beth Aaron, in memory of his father. And that occupied the last decade of his life. It opened in 1927, and he dies in 1931. And let me show you the synagogue again. I mean, it was a beautiful, beautiful synagogue. There it is. Now, this synagogue, so why this is such an amazing story is this synagogue was. By the way, you can read also about, if you're interested, I'll just pull it up here. If you go, I mean, there's books, and I mean, I found a very interesting article about him, but you can read on the Wikipedia page all about the adopted children that he and his wife had, and then, of course, the big fight, which continued on into the communist era, about all of his money. Suffice to say, they should have left China when they could, because I met someone not long ago who was part of this family and claimed that they're entitled to certain money. Now, here's when the mere students or in the books about this write about what I'm going to tell you, they see the Hashgacha Pratit, the divine providence, in a number of different ways. And this is one of them. This synagogue was built. Well, why did he build a synagogue? He wanted to know, memorialize something for his father. And Chacham Abraham said, we'll build a synagogue. They built the synagogue in the zone, the international zone. Shanghai was divided. You also had what they called the French Concession. And then you had the international zone from when it was an international city. And this applied even when Japan entered, until Japan entered the war against the Allies. And then later in 1943, France also gave it up. But there were no Jews living there. This was the area of all the business. So why build a synagogue there? Because Chacham Abraham said, well, thinking to the future, in the future, Jews are going to move to that area, and therefore we need to be prepared. Well, it never happened. The synagogue is built in 1927, but till 1941, no Jews are living there. It was very difficult to get a minyan. The place is empty. Furthermore, they built a kitchen. Think like today, our shuls. In those days, it was very unusual. Shuls didn't build kitchens. You know, maybe in America, when they started with the idea of a Jewish center, you build a kitchen. But they had a huge kitchen, like we think of today, for hundreds of people. So they were going to have weddings and simchas and everything. It had never been used, not even once. It was just there because no Jews lived there. And that shows us Eben Hardoun when he gave the money. So and in perpetuity, they had money to keep it going. So when you think in terms of divine providence, they come, the Sephardic community agreed, and Rabbi Ashkenazi, you know, spoke to them about this, that the Mir students, they have a place. So as soon as they come to Shanghai, they're taken to the Beth Aaron Shul. They even slept there at first before money came from Vlad Atzela, and they were able to get apartments, and everything was perfect. And this picture, which I will show you again, let me pull it up here. This is in, as you can see now, this is in the Beth Aaron synagogue. Downstairs, you see upstairs where the women's gallery would be. I think it's the mirror a little firmer because you see the little curtains there for if the women would ever come. I don't know how often the women would come because they didn't live that close to there because they rate, I think they that that's so it's a little higher mechitza maybe, but that is the sanctuary of the Beth Aaron synagogue. One more interesting thing. It's when at the dedication of the synagogue, Hardoun, who still remembered from his youth Torah things, he said, "This will be a synagogue, you know, in memory of my father, and forever it will be a synagogue to pray in accordance with the Nusach, the liturgy of Baghdad. Now we have a problem because if the Mir students are there, they're going to be davening Ashkenazic. Chacham Abraham said that the best thing we can do, we're so fortunate to have the Mir students here, that certainly we're not bound by what Hardoon said. Okay, so as I said, the Mir students begin there. Money was sent to allow them to get apartments, and even after Pearl Harbor, and money can no longer be sent. It still was sent through Uruguay, it was sent through Switzerland, and it wasn't just money being sent for the Mir students. Money, they had to establish a boys' school and a girls' school, a Beis Yaakov, and the money for all this was coming from America. Now, we have a description from one of the Mir students, who was later a Rosh Yeshiva in Israel, of how he and how his friends felt when they first arrived in Shanghai. The man's name is Tzvi Kahana. Rabbi Tzvi Kahana. Now, Rabbi Tzvi Kahana is famous for a different reason. He actually, those who were with me in Berlin, you remember Rabbi Ehrenberg, Rabbi Kelman, that's his father-in-law, Rabbi Tzvi Kahana. But the reason Rabbi Tzvi Kahana is famous is for something else, which I will show you. Hold on a second, I gotta pull this up here. For some reason, many people met the Lubavitcher Rebbe, as we know. And however, there was this Rabbi Tzvi Kahana. He comes to meet the Lubavitcher Rebbe in a famous meeting. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe, I was told by one Chabadnik, it is the only time. I'll play it for 2 minutes so you see it. I think you'll be able to get sound, but you can also read it. It's the only time the Lubavitcher Rebbe ever gets angry, I think, and calls his opponents mechutzafim. And so Rav Tzvi Kahana is famous in the Chabad world for this video I'm going to show you now. Just we'll play 2 minutes of it, and then I'll explain, if those who don't know Hebrew, what the Rebbe is talking about and what's going on here. And I heard from Rabbi Ehrenberg that Rav Shach was very angry at Rav Tzvi Kahana, who's a Litvish from the Mir, and he was Rosh Hashiva also, for even going to speak to the Rebbe. But this is one of the most famous of the Rebbe videos. So let me put this up here. Oh, and I have to share the computer sound with you. So, and watch this, and let me enlarge it for you.
Und die, was haben sie gehört, haben zu tun mit Johannes, aber auch die Medien haben die Gefühle zum anderen. Ich sage, die Medien hat doch ein bisschen gern mit Kreuz. Ich sage, die Rede ist immer besser gesagt. Fisten wir rein, man macht Leute zwischen ihnen, weil das in der Jacke, die Gule, Schleimer, die Dreh, die Schiere zu zählen. Also ich denke, die Mörder, als wäre die Kutzte Jagd. Man sagt, um die Kresse der Kutzte. Ich habe viel Geschichte mit der Sache von Suche, was mir dieses Spiel den Mittler beschreiten. Den Mittler beschreiten.
Okay, so what this is talking about is Chabad, they don't sleep in a sukkah. They actually say you're not allowed to sleep in a sukkah. The Rebbe there says Bells doesn't either. That's not true. We know that certain Rebbes didn't, but they this people, the bells definitely do. So that became a big bone of contention in Rav Schacht's time, that why doesn't Chabad sleep in the sukkah? So they have a Kabbalistic thing. So here he's going there, and it became famous because this goes on for 20 minutes talking about this. I encourage all of you to watch it. And then at the end, Rav Tzvi Kahana, he accepts what the Rebbe says, and his wife comes in to get a bracha, the whole bit. And so very interesting. So Rav Tzvi Kahana, though, and I'll end with this, and then we'll take the questions. He talks about, there's a little of a memoir, when they arrived in Shanghai and they were told that they're going to the Sephardic synagogue and the Sephardim are going to take care of them and everything, they had no idea what to expect. They never had seen Sephardim. They didn't know what a Sephardi was. He says that we thought the Sephardim are going to look like the Chinese. That is, they thought the Chinese they see in the street, that's what Sephardim would look like. He says, just like the Chinese people who carried our luggage to the buses. Or perhaps he said, well, the 10 tribes, they knew nothing about Sephardim. And then he says, how shocked the students were to see how people would, you know, rickshaw. People would have these rickshaws, they'd take people. And that the West, the whites, as they were called, the wealthy people, the rich people, the Europeans, they'd kick and scream at these Chinese people who would be taking them around on the rickshaws. And he says how the yeshiva students were shocked. How could people treat others that way, the way they were? Also, there's another Meir student. His name is Abraham Winehouse. He recalls, quote, I will never forget the morning I went out and saw the bodies of dead children left out because they had died of starvation or frozen overnight. Then we had to get used to riding rickshaws. Imagine using a human being as an animal. We were not trained for that. It is not the Torah way, but you get used to it after a while. You realize that it helps to make a poor man to make a living. And in fact, Rabbi Yecheskel Levenstein, the Mashkiach, he instructed the students who were very uneasy. They didn't want to take a rickshaw. I mean, it's just like it felt like you're treating a person like an animal. But Winehouse tells us that Rabbi Yecheskel said, go on the rickshaw, because if you don't do it, you're going to be, let's say, you're going to be pious. I don't want to go on the rickshaw. You're depriving the rickshaw person of a chance to make a living. So you're going to say, well, it's beneath me. I would never do something like that, have someone pull me. But just Rabbi Cheskel said, just think what you're doing. Now the person can't make a living and will starve. And Rabbi Cheskel told the Talmidim, the students, when you go on the rickshaw, to leave as large a tip as you can and to act decently towards the rickshaw drivers. And this is given as an example how in all areas, Rabbi Cheskel, even in the city of Shanghai, would be able to find ways to, you know, put forth the Musar personality. That was his job as the Mashkiach, to develop the students with the proper Musar personality. And we shall see next class how the Mir Yeshiva, in the eyes of the students, is able to reach the same heights, if not greater, than they reached in Europe. So, but I see it's already 9:29. So let me stop here. I've been speaking straight now for an hour. Let me look at some of the comments and questions, and I will read them out if I answer them, because the people, we have a lot of people online. We have 133, but we have more people who listen, I think, or not, and they like to hear what's said. Leo Levin is Levy is the uncle's name. No, it's the mother. It's not Levin. It's the mother's. I don't want to search for it now here. Look in the book. It's Nat Lewin's mother's brother. I forget the last name. Okay, so Charlie says that during Chol Hamoed Sukkos in 1867, the date line was moved. So yeah, the date line's changed, has changed. But there's a shita which holds that where the date line is now, where is still halachically should, it's close to there. I don't know, the average person, I don't know, I think they just follow wherever they are, and that's in line with the shita of Bnei Tzion and others, and also with Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank and Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer. About Mao says that they were first. Why were they 16, 17, 18? Why not number one? They were the first to use the Curacao visa. If you had a visa, let's say, to Palestine.
Aliza answered the question. Look a little further.
Oh, okay. Oh, you got, okay. Very good.
You can scroll down.
Yeah, I see that. I see that.
Everybody who's online, they can also scroll down.
Yeah, everyone can low down. Oliza says they appear to be people with genuine visas to Japan. Either that, or they could have also received, could have got transit visas. There were people who got genuine visas to Japan. If you read Hill Levine's book, there was an engineer, for instance. This engineer, and there's other people that got genuine visas. But also, if you had a transit, the hop of the Curacao was that you now could get a transit visa, get a place to go. But if you go to Paraguay, you also could get that, presumably. Okay. Thank you very much, Aliza, for the article. And I'm glad I was able to set this right. If I write anything about it, I will set the matter straight. Thomas said, which I did not know, I haven't been to Mumbai, I've been to Delhi, that there's a Jewish prostitute cemetery in Mumbai, which that would have meant Iraqi Jews. I didn't know. And yes, the Jewish gangsters, we all know. My grandmother grew up in Brownsville. Jewish gangsters, we have lots of Jewish gangsters. And she recalls from Florida, what's his name? Not Bugsy Siegel. The one who
Lansky.
Meyer Lansky. She recalled him walking his dog. I can send you the link. Just Google Aliza Low and my grandmother, Sugihara. You'll get the article. You are correct that Moshe, that Rabbi Golevsky, he gave the hashgacha for some of the vegetarian restaurants. He went on Aliyah a few years ago, maybe about 5-6 years ago. He told me something amazing, Rabbi Golevsky. He said that in his opinion, that Rabbi Polnayev from YU, who's a beloved Rebbe, many, many children, grandchildren, Torah observant, he thought that he was a bigger lamdan than Moshe Feinstein. Not a posek, but he thought in terms of a lamdan, he thought Rabbi Polnayev was, that's one, he told me many other things. He's born in Brisk. Yes, and there's an organization, correct, Rafael, Jewish Association of Protection of Girls and Women, and you had that in England, you came out of England. In Germany, I believe you had also, there was an Orthodox woman who was very involved with this, and in Argentina. In Argentina, it was a huge issue there. TI, that's what I was looking for. And you had him for Gemara. Very nice. And Rafael says, Seidman, in her new book, Seidman, sir, which I just came out about with a review on Naomi Seidman's book on Sarah Schneier. She now is in Toronto. And also she mentions that. And yes, David says, Simcha Zelig Rieger's grandson, namesake Simi Rieger, is a former basketball player and sports commentator in Israel. I did not know that. But Simcha Zelig Rieger's son was also a rabbi, and he wrote a memoir, which was published in my series at Academic Studies Press, that Sarah Rieger, Professor Sarah Rieger's father, she's from Brooklyn College, it's about his life in the yeshiva world in Europe. But I didn't know that about the, I guess, is that Sarah Rieger's brother or nephew, I guess? Very nice. Mutti asks, well, I discussed the money sent from Rabbi Cutler where he excludes Chabad from benefiting. And yes, I did discuss it, as you heard, and I said, correct me if I'm wrong, but I looked at the documents and Rabbi Aaron Cutler is not mentioned. It's Kalmanovitz. That's K is Kalmanovitz there. At least all the documents I saw. And yes, you are correct. The Lubavitch had their own funding, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know if Ephraim Bricks is a grandson. Okay, any recording of the Space Tin proceedings? No. I don't have it. All we have is discussions of it. I've never seen anything. And we have a document in which is sent to, I forget now, a document from right after the war, I think 1946, which is sent to Shanghai, if I'm not mistaken, which sets out all everything that happened during the war years. How could the money continue to come from America after December 7, 1941, Charlie asks. It went through Uruguay. There was a Rabbi Molevsky. Molevsky, he was a rabbi in, I think he's in Toronto now, but he was in Memphis and Buffalo. His grandfather, great-grandfather, I'm not sure, was Slobodka Varon Molevsky. He became rabbi, chief rabbi of Uruguay. So money went through him. Money also went through Switzerland. This was illegal. You can't send money. This wasn't the only time they did this. And that's how the money got there. It could not go directly. How far is Harbin from Shanghai? Good question. We spoke about...
It'll come up later in the comments.
Okay. I'm looking online. It says 2,286 kilometers. So you need to take a train. Zev says that nine Lubavitch students came to Montreal and started middle college there. Yes, Charlie's correct. Money did not go through Turkey, but it did go through Switzerland. Great book about the Abraham family from Baghdad. If you search the Abraham family, you hear a lot. The family's being spoken about. There were Orthodox Jews, plenty of Orthodox Jews in Shanghai as well. But the community, the Beth Aaron, this people ran the Beth Aaron synagogue, that was the Sephardic community. We will see that the Sephardim we call them Sephardim, even though they're from Baghdad. That's the convention. Solomon Sassoon claimed that the Baghdadi Jews, they go all the way back to the Talmud. So there's no Sephardi element there at all. But okay, convention, for whatever reason, we've started to call everyone who's not Ashkenazic Sephardic. But the Baghdadis, we will hear about how they were influenced by the Mir Yeshiva in a way that people might not have expected. An influence that wasn't just for a couple of years, but continued permanently. People even came back after the war with the Mir Yeshiva to America. And Baghdad, yes, via India. You start in Baghdad, and then you go to India, and then you come both. The Hong Kong also was Baghdadi. I don't know if there was a Mincha Minyan. I don't know anything. Sima says, I came to America from India, Sephardic, but this is Ashkenazi. I'm Ashkenazi. I guess that means no kitniot for you. Question is, why the rabbi did not give an answer based on halacha to Rav Kahana? Again, you have to speak to the Chabadnikim here. The Chabad has a shita, and they're not bound by, just because you open up the Mishnah Berurah, let's say, they have Kabbalistic reasons that they do things. What's interesting is the fact that a Lithuanian Rosh Yeshiva has such respect for the Rebbe that he goes to the Rebbe to ask him this question, and he wants to say what the B'nai Torah are saying. This was during the period when, and the Lubavitch Rebbe is correct, this is not a new matter. This is a matter that they were doing in the 60s, in the 50s, in the early 20th century. In the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, it does say to sleep in the sukkah, but there are many things in the Shulchan Aruch HaRav which the Rav, Rosh Hashanah himself, didn't do. This is an old practice that goes back, if not to the beginning of Chabad, very early on. And no one attacked Chabad for this in the 19th century. No one attacked Chabad in the early 20th century. In the 70s, all of a sudden, when in the 80s, when the Chabad is being attacked, then, you know, the sukkah, the sleeping in the sukkah. So what the Lubavitch Rebbe was saying is that, why are they bringing this up now? Why all of a sudden are they using this to attack us when we didn't invent this? We're just doing what our parents and our grandparents and great-grandparents. And he said, it's because there are certain people who want to make mochama, and they want to make machokes, and that's why they're doing it. And this is the only time I know of, and I asked a few Chabad people, the Rebbe would respond to Rav Shach, he would do other things, but obliquely. Like when Rav Shach said that the Holocaust was because people sinned, the Rebbe gave a firm regin where he said, no, you can't say that the Holocaust is because people sinned, but he wouldn't respond directly. He just would say, you know, when we think about the Holocaust, don't say it's because of this. And this example is the only time I know of where he actually, he responds directly and says that they're just interested in making machlokas. Generally, the Lubavitch Rebbe's attitude was to go above the fray. You know, and let them argue and scream, but we're just going to do our own thing. Here, for whatever reason, is he, Ratzvi Kahana's reason was at the time, this was everyone was attacking Chabad for being non-halachic. And he, who was someone who respected the Rebbe, you'll see later, his wife comes to ask for a bracha. His wife is the daughter of the Einayim L'Mishpat Rebbe, Yitzhak Arieli, great Talmud Chacham in Yerushalayim. And it seems that he wasn't trying to provoke it. He didn't know that they were videoing and it would be on YouTube. He simply wanted to get a good explanation as to what's the justification for not sleeping in the sukkah. And the Rebbe doesn't give him the justification. The Rebbe just goes on and on about how they're just, but if you look in, they speak about that today, it's there's evil forces that are out there. We don't have the same Kedusha like we used to have. You can speak to Chabadnikim. It's beyond my... my level. Neri C, the Rebbe was telling him, Levi tells us that the Rebbe explained it in Likutei Sichos, volume 29. No, I wouldn't say, David, it's imagine someone asking something of the Rebbe to ask about the kashrus of Satmar or Shlita or something. I mean, he's a Talmud Chacham. He's asking the Rebbe, what's the basis of this? And it's more, he's saying he wants to go back because he wants to give an explanation so they don't attack Chabad. They were persecuting Chabad. It was a terrible situation. And there, Moshe Rosenberg, Mapport has a lengthy article, et cetera, et cetera. The role of the Amshinover, Jack Yellen asks. The Amshinover was very close to the, you know what, let me make do that at the beginning of next class, talk a bit about the Amshinover. And, you know, the opponents of Chabad say it's only in cold countries. I don't know, leave it for someone else. Sternheim, thank you, Louisa. Jack says the Dateline issue from a practical perspective was explored in a kosher occurrence published by a Star Case some time ago. Yes, if you Google Halachic Dateline, you get that article, you get a number of articles, you get a summary, an abridgment. There's a rabbi in Lakewood named Taplin, very interesting person. I don't know him personally, but he was a student of Gustman. He's published a number, but he wrote like a 700-page book on the whole international Dateline, and there's about 75 pages there which presents the issue, the different shitos and everything. And then Chaim Zimmerman, who I believe he just completely defends the Chazon Ish. Yes, Moshe Simon Shoshan is Rabbi Polyev's great-grandson. Another one of Rabbi Polyev's grandsons lives in my town, Yanki Polyev. I knew Rabbi Polyev's son. Anyone who was in Vacation Village knew Rabbi Polyev's son, or anyone who lived in Highland Park, Edison area knew Rabbi Polyev's son. They recently published from Rabbi Polyev. This is great. He was a Talmud of Rav Gifter was a Talmud of his at Yeshiva College. And they published the letters of Rabbi Gifter and Rabbi Polyev. So they're basically Torah letters. But in between the Torah letters, they have the other stuff. And you see Rabbi Gifter, his anger, he has a negative comment about Rabbi Revel. And just you get a sense of who Rabbi Gifter was, although he retains the greatest respect for Rabbi Polyev. You really get a sense of Hashkafa Rabbi Gifter from these letters. What drove so many Jewish women to prostitution? Poverty. I once heard the husbands left for America and abandoned thousands of women. Furthermore, they had no money in Eastern Europe, and these guys would come, and they would marry them. They'd make shiduchim with them, and then when they get them back to Argentina, they find out they're not, rather than being husbands, they throw them in a brothel. And after a few nights in the brothel, then the women, what can they do? They're stuck there. They can't go anywhere. They'll never get married. So they basically resign themselves to that life. Also, you had people who would come thinking that they're coming for, jobs as maids and other things. There was all sorts of ads in the newspaper. Don't send your daughters off there if you don't know who's coming. But people would actually come and marry them and then bring them back, or come there to get them to marry them in Argentina. Women would come and say, I have my son, we'll marry you. I mean, women were involved with this. And these were the Tameim. But they, even though they were the Tameim, and they were pimps and madams, and they were doing all this, they still were Jews, and they needed a shul. And they needed a cemetery, and they couldn't be buried with the other Jews because they didn't let them. And they had to have their own rabbi, and their own, because they're Jews. What can you do? Yes, let me see. Yes, Rabbi Malevsky. Okay, yes, he's from that. He's Rabbi Malevsky's, I don't know if it's his grandfather or great-grandfather. And not only did he have a lot of his chliot, the letters that were sent with instructions from America to Rabbi Malevsky had to be sent in code. Just like the letters that were sent, they would send letters to Switzerland, which were then supposed to be sent on to Shanghai. They would use like Talmudic expressions. Or for example, if they wanted to refer to Rav Aaron Cutler, they would say, I was looking at the Parsha today, and it mentions that Aaron said he has to transfer something. In other words, they wrote in a way that if you knew what they were talking about, you could figure out. And some of these things, it's brilliant, the code that they use, using Torah verses and Talmudic verses to say what they want to say. They did this in telegrams also. Where can you find the video of the Rebbe you showed? If you email me, Yaakov, I'll send you the link, and anyone else, and it makes great watching. There's the link. Oh, you see it. Okay. Yes, in Highland Park, Mel, Rabbi Polyev's daughter, and Rabbi Polyev's son, they both came with me to Torah in Motion last summer. They came to Central Europe. Rabbi Polyev did leave behind a private memoir. I have a copy of it. I've been hoping one day I'll write about it. But he says, Warsaw Ganovim, Hasidic Rebbe of Ganovim, told of by Shlomo Karlbach. I don't know about the Hasidic Rebbe of Ganovim. What I can tell you is that you had groups of Jewish bandits in the 1600s, 1700s, up until modern times. And these were bandits. In fact, they lived out in the forest and things. And when they needed to get married, they'd bring the rabbi out there. When they had a lot of questions, they would go to the rabbi. You had all sorts of craziness going on, which is hard for us to imagine because the way history is written, you know, well, we speak about the intellectuals and the rabbis and the other things. We don't really talk too much about the other, the Jewish underworld, in which you had. When we go to Eisenstadt in the summer, some of you have been with me to Central Europe, I tell you the case about the people who ran into the church and they stole all the precious objects from the church. And then they go to the rabbi to ask him to divide it halachically between them. Because even though they're ganavim, they need to know how it's divided. And this led to a mayor of Eisenstadt having to leave because he was implicated in this. It's amazing. Okay. So David Fishman, who David was not with us, I think, on the last Netziv class when I showed a picture of your father and spoke about his important work. But David tells us about the Yiddish play based on Jewish prostitution in New York City. And we have all the statistics you'll see in Bristow on that. And it's... Okay, so finally we get, David says again, Eisenbabel, Jewish bandits in Russia, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot you can talk about, a lot that's been written. Portnoy, actually, in his recent, no relation, to, as far as I know, to the Rabbi Portnoy we spoke about on the Yiddish press. He records a lot of the scandals and everything recorded in the Yiddish press. I forgot the name of the book, but it's he basically gets out all the juicy stuff from the Yiddish press. And we'll end with this, that Charlie says, Trotsky had a, Lev Bronstein had a rabbi officiate at his first wedding. So there you go. Well, thank you all. It was very nice. We will pick up next class with the Mir Yeshiva in Shanghai. Good night, everyone.